Hi, Bhaskar Sankara. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Bhaskar Sankara is the founder and editor of Jacobin, a relatively new radical journal. Bhaskar has recently written a book. It's hot off the presses, titled Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. The book is hopeful, showing that the U.S. is ripe for democratic transformation. It draws its lessons from the history of the left that he discusses in brief but fascinating detail. And Socialist Manifesto also discusses the transformation, reconstruction, revolution. It's the process for gaining political power. What can be done today, starting today, to build the foundations and create momentum toward that necessary, radically democratic and sustainable society? And you can meet and talk to and hear Bhaskar tomorrow evening at Powell's, the Burnside store, at 7:30 p.m. That's tomorrow at Powell's. So, Bhaskar, over the last near half century, the left has tasted a good deal of disappointment and defeat. It's lost a great deal of institutional capacity. Your book acknowledges that, but Socialist Manifesto, it breathes optimism and promise about the socialist challenge. Tell us why. What's the basis of your optimism?
Well, I think for one thing, from a certain perspective, the history of the modern workers' movement, the history of the last 150 years, has also been a history of success, not just defeat. We live in a country in which, in a world in which the power of capital has in fact been chastened by class-conscious radical movements. We've seen the abolition in the advanced capitalist world of child labor. We've seen the advent of modern political democracy, which is still very inadequate, but still far better than what our rulers would have given us if we hadn't fought for it. You know, God rested on the seventh day. Many of us still get the sixth day off. So there has been a lot of achievement. And all this achievement happens when working people realize that their problems are social problems and the potential solution to these problems are collective. And I've been involved in various, you know, organizing efforts and things like that. And what I've seen is that people are fundamentally rational. They don't like being oppressed. They don't like being bullied. They don't like being exploited. And when given a better option, people will, in fact, fight back. Now, it's sometimes not rational to fight back, sometimes too risky to do a job action in which everyone could get fired. It's sometimes too risky to pursue politics as a solution to your problems instead of private individual solutions or asking family and friends for help and relying on your local community and things like that. So I think the goal of radicals, the goal of people on the left more broadly, is to just provide and help create the infrastructures of dissent that can, in fact, make collective action a more viable choice. So you're seeing it now in, let's say, things like the nationwide teacher strikes that have been happening.
Right. I think you, in the book, you talk about other reasons for hope. For example, you point out that capital is crisis-prone. That's in the short term, but in the long term, it seems to me that things can't stay as they are. The climate crisis, the housing crisis, the crisis in health care. Capital is moving in a direction where it's bringing on requirements for enormous change in the way the economy and society is shaped.
So I think one thing that's very interesting is often as socialists, we're trained to think about capitalism's contradictions, about the way in which the system is inherently unstable, about all the tensions that are baked into it. But in fact, I think what's really incredible about capitalism is its ability to absorb challenges, its mechanisms for stability. And I think what's at the center of this mechanism is the fact that workers and capital are, in fact, dependent on each other, but it's not an equal dependency, it's an asymmetrical dependency. Any individual worker needs their job more than any capitalist needs an individual worker. And this in itself tends to limit the extent of working class challenge to capitalist power, because within capitalist societies, you need private firms that are profitable, and that's the only way that we survive. So I see that the dilemma of social democracy, the dilemma of a lot of kind of our efforts at making reforms within the system, is that it both strengthens the position of working class people to start demanding more and more things, because you're much more apt to go on strike and start demanding things if there's full employment, basically, rather than if there's 20% unemployment. You're much more likely to go on strike if you're not dependent on your employer-provided health care and you're in a country with universal health care. Yet at the same time, the mechanism of control is still in the hands of capital, because capital can always withhold investment. They could always say, you know, listen, you're getting too raucous. We're not going to invest in new productive enterprises. We're going to maybe even flee to another country. Things change. So this is the dilemma that we try to confront, and this is why we can't just settle for reforms within the system, because ultimately capitalists have the power in their hands. They'll be able to roll back these reforms. So that's why we need to think about, how do we create a layer of worker-owned institutions? How do we expand the sector that's publicly owned? How do we do things to take this power away from capital?
We have the alternatives. We know so much more. Part of the book is your history of the left. We know a lot more about doing politics and the kind of politics that could succeed. But we also have alternatives throughout both social life and economic life. Cooperatives work. We really do know a whole lot more about how to live democratically, thanks a good deal to the women's movement and, of course, the Black movement in the United States and anti-racism, but we have a sense of alternatives. Maybe you could talk about those in the economy.
I mean, I think we do. I think people have a sense that things can be better in a vague sense, but I would actually counter that today, a lot of people, even though they believe that a different world is desirable, isn't necessarily, but they're not positive that a different world is technically possible. Part of what we need to do is actually inculcate this idea that there is a different way and another system is possible. That's why in the book, I try to open in the first chapter by presenting a model, a vision of what a day in the life of a social citizen could look like, about what a feasible socialism could look like, because a lot of books that say they're making the case for socialism are in fact making the case against capitalism, which is still very valuable, important work, but I think we actually need to present people with a vision that makes sense. So even though there are cooperatives, there are these institutions that are existing that might signal that today, they're still operating within the framework of a competitive capitalist economy. And a lot of these institutions are easily prone to fall into the traps of NGOism or things like that, that don't really pose a real complete alternative to the governed and built around the interests of a small minority of private capitalists.
This is Bill Resnick for KABU. It's Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Bhaskar Sankara, the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine, who's now on tour. He'll be in Portland tomorrow introducing his book, Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. We've been discussing how, though the powers that be are powerful, they're also vulnerable. We have a potential for movement from below. We've had movements from below throughout our history that have, in fact, changed the way the system operates, and we have a lot of room now for doing it again. Bhaskar, you talk about that, how to make the transition or revolution, some call it, or transformation, probably a little bit of all three. Tell us, how do we move towards solving the existential problems of this society?
Well, I think we need to not counterpose ourselves to the daily struggles of people for a little bit more dignity or a little bit more bread and comfort. And I think in that sense, if you can't put something like Medicare for All, let's say, on the table, how are you going to put these broader questions of worker control of their workplaces on the table? So I think immediately our set of demands are pretty clear. I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of what his campaign represents is an immediate set of demands that will give people fighting for working class people of all races, fighting for a little bit more stability, a little bit more dignity, a little bit less kind of stress and anxiety that comes with being in medical debt, of having student debt, of having all these things that are quite common to our lives in the United States, but isn't even the case in other countries in the world that are obviously still capitalist countries with their own set of gross inequities, but at the very least more of a safety net. So I think if you fight for these reforms, they're not only good in and of themselves, in that they not only improve the lives of people, but they enable people to start asking deeper and more radical questions. There's a small portion of the left that used to think that the welfare state would buy off workers, that would make them wedded to the system and to their nation and whatever else. In fact, if you look at the history of social democracy in Europe, if you look at the history of these reform movements, in fact, reforms tend to beget more reforms and more radical reforms. And eventually you start thinking about deeper issues of industrial democracy, workplace democracies, and not just issues of bread and butter. But I think for starters, the movement around Medicare for All is really inspiring. The widespread support that's building now for something like a jobs guarantee is extremely exciting. And I think this is where leftists and progressives more generally need to orient towards these existing struggles for day-to-day fights.
Let me state a hypothesis. I think in the struggles for just the bread-and-butter reforms like Medicare for All, universal single-payer medical system, you can talk about the advantages of that system in ways that, in fact, point out to people and give them a sense of their own capacity and power and a hunger for democracy. In the energy system, it's clear that community energy, democratically run, creating cultures of use reduction, they'll work much better than what the investor-owned utilities and the big finance have in store for at least their plans for implementing sun and wind energy. The medical system is, in fact, right now, to some extent, reorganizing within its limited capacity to reorganize towards far more power and decision in people who are not doctors. Nurses, for example, are just fighting for power, and they're gaining it because they're the ones who run the wards and are in power and are often making decisions and, in fact, challenging sort of physician authority. It seems to me we can talk about those things. In talking about Medicare for All, we can talk about why a public system would be far better for patients, and it would be the medical care that our people deserve, just like the teachers are pushing for. So we can talk about a really democratic future even within efforts just to save public education or to get a socialized medical system.
Right. And Bill, it's also the question of how are you fighting for these reforms?
Right.
So you could fight for Medicare for All in a way that really pushes a confrontation against big corporations and against healthcare companies and CEOs, and it's built as a kind of a class conflict of working people demanding something. Or you could fight for healthcare reform in the way that Obama did it, which is by trying to get everyone at the table and trying to create a system that panders and subsidizes to the private industry as it is. So it's not just kind of what you're fighting for, it's how you're fighting for it. I think socialists in particular have a vision of the world that says that if you want to organize to make reforms, you have to organize working people, you have to support unions, you have to support all these other efforts, and you have to actually confront people who have power. We can't just all have nice things. It's going to involve taking some of the power and privilege and wealth from a certain group of people and distributing it to the vast majority of people.
In the Socialist Manifesto, you talk about the labor movement and class struggles. Tell us why you see the labor movement and uniting people as a social class as a fundamental necessity.
Well, socialists have always historically been interested in workers, not because they're weak and oppressed and exploited, but because they're in fact potentially very strong. They're at a very strategic position in the economy by virtue of being in these sites of production, be it places where goods are created, places where services are created. Workers have the power to withhold their labor and actually create disruptions far beyond their numbers. So whereas a consumer boycott of 10 million people might have some effect on the economy, a strike of 1,000 to 3,000 workers strategically positioned in the economy can in fact have just as much of a disruptive effect. So historically, socialists have looked to workers in certain manufacturing sectors. They looked to longshoremen. They looked to these workers that were at these central nodes in the economy and said, all right, these people have certain special social and strategic weight. I think today some of these sectors are different. They're changing. Nurses and teachers, I think, are at a very important sector in the economy, and I think that that's where a lot of our organizing efforts should be going. There's also all these workers working in the logistics field. You know, we're seeing the cropping up of these Amazon warehouses all over the country, and even though a lot of people are afraid of automation and all these other things in these factories, the truth is that if you have an organized base of a few dozen workers at Amazon warehouse, you could potentially create a large disruption in the economy and from that basis push forward a lot of demands. The other thing is, it's really still a mass base. Our union density is low. It's only 10% of the total workforce, 10-11%. A lot of that's in the public sector. But that's still millions of people that are banded together in a political organization political organizations that are fighting not just for wages, but in the best cases, you know, not all the unions are built the same, but in the best cases, are also bringing in political demands too. So it's still an important seat of power. But I think we should not just accept unions as they are. We need to also figure out a way to make them more democratic, less bureaucratic, and actually seats of power and politicization. Unions are often the place where a nurse, for example, who had never been involved in politics before, might see herself as a political actor that has power and can actually influence things that are going on in her community. And that's often the training ground for working class people to the extent they're getting politicized. And obviously, on the other front, there's elections, there's a whole host of social movements and other things, but nothing compares with the strategic power that workers potentially have in their place of work.
You know, that argument goes for our own movements. Often we become top-down and centralized. And what we lose, of course, is the discussion. Democratic unions are extremely important. Putting the stewards and individual workers into positions of power and decision and thoughtfulness and solidarity. But that's also true of our movements. They have to, in fact, educate and provide people with the opportunities for the kind of self-development that makes them into subjects of history, making history rather than being the obedient subjects of other forces. Tell us about the kind of left movements that we need.
Well, yeah, I think we need ultimately to create something where we have institutions that are raising the level of class consciousness and organization across working class communities. It used to be a little bit easier in other contexts for people on the left. You know, you could be on the far left, and let's say you're in Italy in the 1970s, you're going through a working class district in Italy, you would see a bunch of people who were largely in the main, let's say 60%+ of them, were voting for a party that kind of democratic socialist or social democratic party, nominally committed to the cause of socialism, but doing it in a very slow way, or maybe not even really planning to get there, but committed to this horizon of change and that had the sense of self, the sense of being a member of a class that has certain shared political objectives. In the U.S., we often are our starting point where we are not just convincing people that they should pursue a more radical vision of change, but in fact that change is possible and that politics can actually make a difference. So what I envision today is kind of the rebuilding of community organizations that could take a variety of forms. It could be a tenant union. It could be engaging in, you know, sort of even politicized social service work and things like that that are imbued with a sense of class consciousness and raising the expectations and power of people. But right now, to be perfectly honest, the real breakthrough we're seeing is in the electoral realm. So even though I don't think that elections is where we should put all of our energy, it's very clear that something like the Sanders campaign is galvanizing millions to start thinking about themselves and thinking about what they deserve and not just individualizing all these supposed failings. You're unemployed, people are tempted to think that they just need to reformat their CV or that they need to take a coding class or whatever else. But when something like the Sanders campaign comes around, they can maybe see these things not as individual failings, but as social problems that need collective solutions. So I think this is almost like a jump start. And all these socialists now joining DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, there's around 60,000 of them. They can actually, in fact, participate in this process if they're rooted in working class communities of helping to support labor movement struggles, about connecting with things like tenant struggles, about, you know, supporting these local insurgent electoral campaigns. Like I'm calling you now, I'm speaking from Chicago, and Chicago, of course, just elected a half dozen Democratic Socialists to its city council of just 50 people. So you get something like 12% of the Chicago City Council being socialists, many of whom are DSA members. So I think this is super exciting, but obviously just a start. So we're rebuilding a lot of what was lost in the last 3-4 decades of defeat in the United States. It's going to take a long way to get there. I think eventually, to be perfectly honest, we're going to need a independent party that's rooted in the interests of working people, which I think are distinct from the interests of capitalists, about people who own things and have wealth in this country are fighting for different things in different ways than people like me or you that don't have wealth and power. And ultimately, I think we need to have that kind of party, but we have to move in that direction realistically, knowing the limitations on third parties, knowing how difficult it is to make that kind of leap in the United States, and knowing the reasons why we failed in all these attempts to do something like this over the last 120 years.
Let's conclude on a burst of optimism. This last election was a great insurgency against both political, major political parties. The old hands in the parties have been repudiated by the majority of the people. It seems to me we're at a point where people are really looking for alternatives. They know that something is rotten, and a lot of things are rotten, and that things have to change. We're at a point where I think we can convert those suspicions and the anxiety and the insecurity of most people in this country into political action, because the Sanders campaign demonstrated that. Bhaskar, you get the last word.
I think one thing that's really happening right now is that people are fed up and they're looking for alternatives and they're angry. And in 2016, there were only two candidates really speaking to their anger. There was the right populist approach of Trump that told a lot of working people that, in fact, the reason why they weren't getting enough is because women, because people of color, because immigrants, all these other people were getting their slice of the pie. And then on the other hand, there was Sanders saying that, you know, listen, the reason why you're working hard, you're not getting enough, isn't because of immigrants, it's not because of minorities. It's because millionaires and billionaires are getting more and more of the wealth that we are all collectively creating. And the way to get back at them is to band together and have this kind of political revolution to take away some of their power and wealth. And it's insufficient. I think it needs to go even deeper and even further than that, but it's a start.
It sure has to institutionalize in lots of ways where power can be exerted. And
it needs to exist beyond election campaign, exactly.
And defended. Bhaskar Sankara, tomorrow at Powell's, people can meet Bhaskar, talk to him. That's at 7:30 at Powell's, the downtown store. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill, and I hope everyone comes out. It's my first trip to Portland, so I'm looking forward to it.
Bhaskar, good talking to you. Thanks.
Thanks again. Take care. I'll see you soon.
Right. So long.
All right. Bye. Come all ya good work.